This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Come on. We call it the place to be.
The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be.
Place to Be Nation. Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
It is contagious. It is the place to be. And we are live each and every Monday.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
I'm the reason they made the dress code. They figure out what and why when I'm in my fresh clothes. Dresses, I suppose, from my neck to my toes. Neck full of gold, baguettes in my rolls. Rec shows, collect those extra O's. By the E, get the key to the left.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming to you live here from the PTBN studios. And of course, joining me as always, is Hurricane Scotty. Scott, how are you?
Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 464 of the longest running episodic Whether or Not Gold Standard. And you know what? Fuck hurricanes. Fuck all this shit. You know why, JR? Because we did a podcast during Sandy.
Mm-hmm.
So no one could say to us that weather will ever impede the greatest podcast on the planet.
Now, let's not get crazy as possible. But to date, we've been pretty good about not letting that happen.
God, such a blocker. I don't think it'll ever happen. But anyway, it's good to talk to you, sir, as always. And we have a pinch hitter tonight to conclude the Gold Dust Trail. This is kind of like the Iceman King Parsons of the Freebirds. pinch hits when Jimmy Jam Nelson's not around. Pete Schermacher, what's up, Pete?
Not much, guys. How's it going?
Good. One of the voices of the world cast, and this week in wrestling, and what else you got going on these days? Is that it, besides the odd main event stopping?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it, man. I'm gearing up for CWF Fan Fest in October.
Nice.
Which is going to be a blast. October 13th and 14th, I will be doing some podcasts right from the location, so I think that'll be a lot of fun.
Very good, and before you know it, we'll be in New Orleans, right?
Yep, and then the next year in New Orleans. Yeah, that's funny, because we already been some of the other guys have been already planning it out, and so I'm like, okay, I'm just a follower. I'm pretty flexible guy when it comes to that type of stuff.
Yeah, it comes fast, you know, it comes fast.
It does.
I know it. So, all right, Scott, what do we got going on tonight?
Yeah, why don't we dive in? Because we got a pretty meaty show with a lot of fun stuff to talk about, or not fun, I guess, depending on your point of view.
I was like, man, please throw some sarcasm there. Throw some shade.
Yes, plenty of shade, believe me. Because we are concluding, JR, can you believe this? We are concluding the calendar year of 1986 tonight. Can you believe that?
Crazy. It's been a fast turn here.
A big sprint. So let us go to... Now, Pete, you can't do anything to Kelly's desk. If you want to pop the Laney McDonald bobblehead off his desk, that's fine, but you could sit there. We are back at our home office on 33rd Avenue. It is December 26th, 1986, from our home office, venerable Madison Square Garden in New York City, for the final show of the year. And, interesting show, but... The roster, JR, was very busy Christmas week. This is a Friday, actually. The day after Christmas, as customary, Mr. D'Amato can confirm with us that, WWF always did the December house show somewhere around Christmas, either day after or a couple days after. In this instance, the day after Christmas, December 26th. But the rest of the roster... And this may clue us in on why tonight's show is the way it is. The rest of the roster, in some way, shape, or form, were in not one, not two, three different cities, including New York City. So the roster was in four places tonight. May clue us in, guys, on what this show is all about that we're doing tonight. There was a card at the Igloo in Pittsburgh, the old Civic Arena. Here it is. Little Coco and the Karate Kid defeated Lord Littlebrook and Little Tokyo. Butch Reed defeated Jerry Allen. We'll get more on him. Coco Beware defeated Jimmy Jack Funk. The Rougeaus fought the Dream Team to a draw. Boy, wouldn't we wanted that match tonight. Sika defeated Salvatore Bellomo. Jake the Snake defeated George Animal Steel by countout. Barry O defeated Tony Garea. Glad we didn't get that. The JYD beat King Kong Bundy by disqualification. Iron Mike Sharp defeated Tiger Chung Lee. And your main event, Roddy Piper defeated Adrian Adonis. Don't you wish we had that show? but.
Maybe.
But.
I know. Oh, I don't know. I don't want to go all in yet on that one.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that sounds that much better than this one.
The roster was also at the Civic Center in Lansing, Michigan. I don't know if this is, it's not the, I know that's the Breslin Center in East Lansing where Michigan State plays. The Civic Center in Lansing, Michigan, 2,500. Ricky Steamboat defeated World Wrestling Federation Intercontinental Champion Randy Savage by count out. We'll talk more about that feud, JR, in a couple weeks. And also included Billy Jack Haynes, Mike Rotundo, and Dan Spivey. So there was a card there. And your World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, Davey Boy Smith and the Dynamite Kid, were in Calgary for a special Stampede-only show for old Stew, Grizzled Stew. The only match that Mr. Cawthon has here is Davey Boy Smith, Owen Hart, who's he? And Ben Basarab defeated Mukum and Gama Singh and Viet Cong in a street fight.
What do you rate that match, Pete?
What do you think, Pete?
Sounds exciting. Sounds better than anything we damn sure watched today.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, yes. Yeah, I would.
So the roster, the World Wrestling Federation roster, was spread out across four cities and two continents, or two countries, I should say. Two countries on this day, which kind of gives you an idea of why our show is the way it is. Your announcers on this evening, by the way, a sellout at the Garden, no shock, regardless of the card, because it is Christmas and usually the Garden sells out for that show. Gorilla Monsoon in your seat. However, JR, no Mean Gene, thank God, and no Lord Alfred Hayes.
Yes, we'll talk about that
but
in a
sitting, moment. Yes, sitting next to Gorilla on this evening is his primetime partner, Bobby the Brain Heenan, is with us this evening at the table, which brings for some interesting interesting banter. Anything else, JR?
Yeah, we have some notes since our last MSG House show in November. On 11/29 Superstars, Jack Tunney lifted the suspension of Andre the Giant. Andre teases the release of the Princess Bride and tells the fans they will enjoy what he's been doing during that suspension. We also have the Hart Foundation facing the tag champs, the British Bulldogs, in a non-title match with crooked referee Danny Davis calling the match. The Hart Foundation win after a fast count. Adrian Adonis also returned after a couple months off and saved Jimmy Hart to put Roddy Piper in a sleeper on Piper's Pit. On December 6th, the Honky Tonk Man revealed the new manager, Jimmy Hart. And since getting attacked by Randy Savage, resulting in his throat injury, we've been getting weekly progress reports about Ricky Steamboat. In late November, the reports that the doctors recommended that Steamboat retire. A couple weeks later, Steamboat's doctor report said due to his training, Steamboat's progressing faster than expected, but they're still concerned about him returning. With all the complaints about AF running live shows on Christmas and New Year's back in the 80s, it was a regular thing for promotions to work during the holidays. In 1986, they ran two live house shows, like you mentioned. So, pretty big night for them. So, yes, we do head inside the Garden with Gorilla Monsoon, a nice little Christmas treat, joined by Bobby Heenan. For our opening match, the one and only Paul Roma taking on our old friend Terry Gibbs. Gibbs still kicking around, trudging through the circuit. Roma's been MIA from MSG, but as we heard last month, he was touring Australia with SD Jones and the team that was taking over Australia by hot fever, by storm, as
by force.
Roma told it. Yeah. A decent reaction by Roma as we close out 86. Right away, Bobby brings up that Australia trip. Gorilla says that him and SD SD's been tutoring him. After some locking up, Gibbs takes control and hammers away, but Roma quickly turns the tide with an atomic drop and crossbody for two. Gibbs begs off, but Roma comes right at him, lands a stomp before grabbing a side headlock. Gorilla and Bobby talk about the family members. Gorilla takes a shot at Bundy. They then talk about the holidays as Roma cranks away. Gibbs lands a shoulder block, but Roma retaliates with a clothesline for two and goes back to the headlock. The crowd turns on the match as Gibbs breaks free and methodically works Roma over. Heenan thinks Gibbs has lost 10 pounds. Gibbs lands a back elbow for two and pitches Roma to the floor, which Bobby says is a mistake because he's going to give him time to recover. Roma climbs his way back in, but Gibbs meets him and slugs him back outside. As he makes his way back in, Gibbs stays on the offensive, picking up a near fall along the way. Roma comes back and tries for a slam, but Gibbs collapses on top of him for two. Roma battles back again with right hands followed by a monkey slip and a suplex for a near fall. Roma charges Gibbs, who sidesteps and chucks Roma right outside. Heenan calls Roma stupid as Gorilla chastises him for not being in the holiday spirit. Roma scrapes himself up and climbs to the top rope and comes off with a sunset flip for the win, which was almost very ugly. He almost killed himself. Match was decent enough, really trudged along, no real direction. The finish was cool, and Roma kind of had his spots where he shined, but other than that, just not much happening. I went a half star, Scott.
Your official match time is 9:22. I also gave it a half star. Kind of an odd opener, two kind of flunkies. When was the last time we saw Terry Gibbs? 7-8 months probably. I'm sure we saw him earlier in the year. We haven't seen him lately. Otherwise, the match was pretty paint by numbers. You know, Roma's kind of one of the young up and comer guys in the company. Wins some matches, loses some matches, but this was one you knew he was going to win from the beginning. You just wanted to see if it told a good story, and it was okay. It wasn't great. The finisher was pretty scary, but a good risk take by Roma. Wanted to make an impression, so he did. We're talking about it. I'm sure they talked about it, too. Gorilla and Bobby weren't entertaining, but you could tell they didn't have the primetime stage in terms of like their banter is a little different than, obviously, during an actual live house show. They can't get, you know, they do quick hits at each other on primetime because they got to get to the segments. But here they can kind of stretch it out and be funny. And it's almost there, not quite, but it's getting there in terms of their chemistry. In that platform, that environment, but it was good. It was a nice change of pace in terms of commentary. Bobby was, you know, as usual.
Well, Bobby's still kind of like his, you know, you'll see this as the night goes on. He's still kind of more serious and like,
yep.
I'm trying to think like the way he the type of tone he uses is more
very straightforward.
Straightforward and just kind of angry and bitter versus like the more kind of hokey Bobby that he'll become. Like, he's very much more just kind of mean, like very mean spirited, like not in a funny way, just kind of a dick, you know what I mean? Like, he's still
in like manager role kind of,
yeah,
where he's trying to protect a persona where you want the crowd to hate him so he can draw money when he takes the big bump against somebody still,
right
as
right.
opposed to he still hasn't transitioned, like, you know, maybe in the next year or so where he starts transitioning. He's still managing, mind you, but he's transitioning more and more into the booth where he becomes more as a fixture, as a commentator. Here he's still more like the manager who happens to be just commentating.
Yeah, I agree. Yep. 100%. I think that explains it well.
Yeah, no, that, very good, Pete. I think by like mid-88, I think we see the Bobby that we're used to, but we'll get there. Just a change of pace. The match was, you know, what it was, typical opener with two kind of scrubs, and Roma's risk-taking kind of made it memorable, but otherwise, nothing more than a half-star, Pete.
I gave it 3/4 of a star, and anything really stood out. I will say that Roma was a guy I always thought he could do further in the business. Like, right around when he became Power and Glory, I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. He's really blossoming into a really good heel. But once he became a horseman, I think that was like the kiss of death for him because they overstretched on that, and he was never quite ever able to come back from that. And then you hear behind the scenes he was kind of difficult at times. But he never really fulfilled his potential, I thought. I enjoyed that Gibbs. I like that punch off the break. I thought that was pretty cool. Roma was definitely had like the Bruno Sammartino do going on here,
yes.
Playing up the Italian heritage thing. But yeah, this is your straight up get the kid a popcorn, get the other kid a Coke, and grab your stuff and finally find a seat before the real stuff goes. This is just a let's get the show on the road, but don't give them anything too good because they're still gonna. We want to sell merch and concessions to the kids and family, and I enjoy the finish too. But nothing, definitely nothing to write home about. And sad as it is, this is one of the top probably three matches on the show.
I know, right? Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think on the recent For Your Consideration, I thought they talked about Roma well, too, when they were doing the tag team one with Will and Kelly and El Barriqua. They were talking about the about Roma just having that stink on him of the jobber stink that he can never seem to really shed, and it really just kind of hung over him for all these years. So I think that's definitely a big part of it, him never really fulfilling. And the best he was ended up being in, would be in WCW later down the road with the, not with the Horsemen, but with Mr. Wonderful there, Paul Orndorff. Is pretty wonderful. I thought that was probably the best he ever was. And outside of Power and Glory, it's basically the same team, but that's where he excelled at, as being the cocky guy with the power bruiser. He never really broke through your IP. And I think a big part of it too was that the jobber stank that was hanging over him.
Yeah, when you get beat on TV enough, because back in the 80s, you got to remember the TV shows wasn't, for the audience out there, the TV shows just wasn't, it wasn't Raw. Right. It was jobber matches, and this guy was your handsome, he was like your lead mm-hmm. jobber. And so he was getting beat by all the stars and getting wins against, lower ranked guys. So he just never, he had that jobber stench, and even during Power and Glory, he still had that jobber stench, and definitely when he went to the Horsemen, it was like, this guy's he's been on way too much television and lost way too much to be taken serious and stuff. But he always had the potential to be a strong mid-carder, and that's where he kind of found his niche kind of later on with Power and Glory and Pretty Wonderful.
All right, so next up here, we have an interesting, not really a match, it ends up being more of a segment, but we can cover the participants anyway, and that is our old friend Siviafi, still hanging on despite a pretty disastrous year, taking on, first time we're going to see this guy here, that is the Honky Tonk Man, portrayed by Wayne Ferris, began his career in 1977 in Missouri, wrestled alongside training partner Coca Beware. Moved on to Memphis for a while and worked the South, really, in Birmingham and Mobile, Pensacola, as Dynamite Wayne Ferris. Started out as an undercard guy and kind of worked his way up. Became the part of the Blonde Bombers with Larry Latham. They were later put into various feuds and moved around. Headed over to Tennessee as well, appearing in the Nick Gulas Nashville-based territory, Lawler's Memphis-based territory, and, of course, were part of the infamous Tupelo concession stand brawl against Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee. Had stints in the AWA, Crockett, WWC, Southwest, Southeast. He was everywhere before heading over to New York to join the WWF in late 86 as the Honky Tonk Man. Honky made his TV debut on September 28th on Challenge, beating Terry Gibbs, and was pushed as a fan favorite as an Elvis impersonator. Cut a series of promos with Jesse Ventura that began airing, asking fans for a vote of confidence. Promos usually insulted the fans, kind of like Andy Kaufman and others had before him in that, insincere way where he's pretending to be a fan favorite. And, of course, the results came back negative. Honky turned into a cocky villain, as we've seen. Took on Jimmy Hart, who he billed as the Colonel. Of course, a reference to Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker. Pete, any thoughts or comments about Honky's pre-WWF years? Have you seen a lot of his stuff?
I saw a little bit of his Memphis. He was in the original Tupelo Brawl. And so that's always something to hang on it, because people just didn't know that was Honky Tonk Man. It was Wayne Ferris. And because he had blonde hair. If you look closely, then you can see it. But, you wouldn't really notice it. But, he was a good Southern heel type of thing. And that's how he kind of almost like poked fun of it by going up north and kind of doing that. And he a lot of people didn't really respect him as a worker. I always enjoyed him. I always thought he was a really a guy who I don't want to say he was a great worker, but he was a great gimmick. And I always enjoyed him on the TV. I always felt he had a place on the card. He wasn't obviously never going to have the best match on the show, but he had better. Man, he had some fun feuds with Steamboat and Randy Savage, and I really enjoyed. The matches were shit, but I enjoyed him and Brutus Beefcake when I was a kid, and stuff. The character just didn't have a whole lot, which is shocking. Is in reality the character shouldn't have really long legs, but the guy still does decent on the indies and makes decent money working the damn Honky Tonk Man gimmick. So amen to the guy.
Was the gimmick, do you guys know, was he always going to be a heel and they teed it up with the face stuff, or did it just go so poorly that they turned him? Do you guys know the deal on that?
My understanding was Vince misread it and wanted, he thought it was going to be a baby face because everyone loved Elvis.
Okay, so it was planned to be a face. It wasn't like they did the face stuff to set up the heel turn.
Yeah, and then they kind of had to redo it because it just totally didn't get over at all.
Right, okay. All right, so he does enter here against Iviafi, a big debut to close out the year. Gorilla talks about the poor polling by the fans, and Fink asks for a warm New York City welcome for Honky, but he, of course, gets booed soundly. Honky comes out dancing like a nut. Like he was like on like hyperspeed coming out. Like it's like he took you know, all the Honky mannerisms, he'll eventually get down pat. Here he's like on speed with them. He's just like really doing like the hip thing and the thumbs. Like he's like just going super fast through it. It's weird. And he's got some random honky tonk music. Fee's still hanging around doing his thing, finding spots like this. Honky, of course, jumps him as he gets to the ring, cuts him down with a clothesline, and then a swinging neck breaker. The ref just calls to the bell without counting. The ref has Fink announce that there's no contest and no winner because the match never happened. Fee just leaves like a loser. Like just gets nothing. Honky struts around. Weird, of course, gets across that Honky's obnoxious and a heel despite his claims, and Afi just looks like a bum. And, you know, my comments here were on the original segment. Of course, we'll see more of these guys later, but I thought he looked like a stiff and a dud here. And dud is what I gave this, even though it wasn't technically a good match. Do you guys have any comments on this match here, Pete? We'll start with you.
I was more taken aback by his suspenders than the actual big movements and stuff.
Yeah, the suspenders were quite garish.
Yeah, it's like you totally, they were totally tweaking this gimmick all the way through for a while until finally they hit a home run as a pretty good good heel who, you know, he headlined a lot of WWF shows on the B circuit defending that Intercontinental title. So they just finally took a while with the Jimmy Hart, the girls, Betty Sue, and the singing and all that. And finally translated. You know, it felt like they were putting pieces of it together. And then finally, maybe later in the year, we'll see the full gimmick finally hitting. It's always nice to see these early incarnations of the gimmick where they don't quite have it. It's not all smooth sailing, but finally they're able to get it, and he has a pretty fun run.
What do you think, Scott, of this one?
Yeah, it's amazing that Tommy Dreamer would steal this exact outfit 7 years later in ECW. But I'll reserve my comments for the actual second part. But I mean, he looked like he was on, like he just, I don't know, he did a couple of bumps with the agents in the back. I don't know what the fuck his problem
was. He was like flying out of the ring. It was crazy.
It was ridiculous. Why don't we? I'll hold off. Let's go to the next match.
All right, that next match is a tag team bout featuring the Hart Foundation taking on old Corporal Kirchner and Dick Slater. Very random match here. And Gorilla says it's a Texas-style tag match, and then says, no, it's an Australian-style match. And then it's just a regular tag. So I don't know what the fuck they were talking about. Slater just being wasted away in these spots, completely miscast from the start. Kirchner's lucky to even be hanging around. The Harts get booed soundly as they arrive in their new pink and black attire without Jimmy Hart. Kirchner still gets his theme music, and watching the American and Confederate flags jog out together is a bit counterintuitive. That was kind of weird as they jogged out with those flags flying. Bobby isn't aware of where Jimmy is, and he says not to worry himself about such things. Gorilla also presses him for info on Andre's reinstatement, but Bobby dodges that. We get some stalling early as Anvil removes Hitman's glasses and plays that up for a minute. Bobby asks why Kirchner's wearing camo. He says there's no trees around. Hart and Kirchner finally get things rolling as Gorilla and Bobby debate the speed advantage. We battle through some stalemates and more stalling until the frustrated Hart tags in Anvil, who sleepwalks into a pair of arm drags. Hart tries to come in to help, but Slater chases him away, leading to a race around the ring. Anvil comes out too, and Slater fends off both men, wiping them both out to a pop. Gorilla thinks the Harts are disoriented without their manager. Anvil comes in and slams Kirchner and tags Brett, who drills him with a sharp elbow off the middle rope. The Harts punish Kirchner, tagging in and out, double-teaming and cheating and clubbing away. Bobby says Kirchner needs to tag and find a new career, like at an army surplus store selling fatigues. The Harts keep the pressure on Bobby as Bobby puts over the Hitman's ability. Kirchner finally dodges Hart and dives into the tag to Slater, who comes in and cleans house. Slater's red hot, but that ends when Neidhart drills him with a knee to the back as he hits the ropes. Anvil comes in and works the back and tags in Brett, who grinds away, getting near falls. Anvil gets a tight bear hug, but the Harts did what they could to maintain and cheat and to keep control. The double team backfires, though, as they try a double chop, but Slater dives into their arms, pulling them into each other. The Harts tackle and maul Slater as the refs just watch, but Slater slips free and tags out. Kurt Sharon loads on Anvil and Gorilla is at a loss as to who's legal for the hearts and takes a couple shots at the ref. Kirchner twists Anvil into a Boston Crab, but the Hitman breaks it up. As the ref gets Slater out of the ring, Anvil hoists Kirchner up, and Hart hits him with a clothesline for the win. This was just fine at its core. Basic tag framework that basically works well no matter what. However, everything felt a step slower than normal, especially when Kirchner's in there. He's always just behind. The Hart's executed well, but he couldn't keep up with everything. It kind of felt sluggish. Slater was great in spurts, but doesn't get it a win, and again, continues to be wasted. I thought this was fine. It could have been much better. I just went 2 stars on this, Scott.
Yeah, your official match time is 12:36. I gave it 2 stars as well. Anvil and Hitman look solid. They looked good. You could tell they're primed for something. It was kind of random. I guess we don't have to really deal with Corporal Kirchner as anything of anything anymore. He's pretty much just a mop-up job
yeah.
guy.
Yeah.
And
still has his music. Still gets his music.
Yeah. He does have his music. This whole stretch, very perplexing for me about Dick Slater. Here was a guy I loved in Crockett as a heel, Dirty Dick Slater. And he comes here, and the whole rebel thing is nice, and, you know, it's... But I feel like so much teeth was taken out of him.
Mm.
And, I mean, obviously he came here to make a, you know, to make some scratch. That's obvious, but... he was definitely a better bad guy, and he works like a Southern guy. His punches look stiff. Like, punches in WWF always look kind of 50-50, but, you know, Southern punchers always look like they're punching, and it looked a little – they were a little kind of mis – that's what I'm thinking of. It looked a little unorganized in the middle of the match.
Yeah.
And I feel like Slater isn't quite that WWF kind of guy, which is kind of sad because, again, I loved it. I loved Dick Slater in Crockett and in Georgia. Always a fun guy to watch. Otherwise, the match was fine, but you can tell the Hart Foundation are clearly on the road to better things, and things are moving up for them. I think the whole theory we had all year, JR, about them being in limbo was over. I think they're definitely on the fast track right now and are the best looking heel team mm-hmm. in the company right now, and this match showed it. And I love that. I think that, I don't know if it's the first time we've seen the Hart attack.
I think so. Well, it's the first time we've seen it for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. First time we've seen it.
I don't know. When
and
they
treat it like a. Yeah, they treat it like a double team finisher because they do it when the ref's back's turned. Mm-hmm. Typically, good heel stuff, and we get accustomed to it obviously as we move forward. So, I gave it 2 stars, Pete.
I went a half a star.
Oh wow!
I just hated this match. It, I just felt the Hart Foundation felt like they took like 80% of it. It felt like the babyface's shine was really short. And it was just felt like a really long squash match. The only thing I got excited about was watching Slater work a couple spots with the Hart Foundation, but that wasn't enough to save this match for me. I just thought it was slow, plodding, was clumsy at times, overly formulatic, and essentially just a long squash. It's like, I don't need a long squash. Just give me, make my squash just 4 minutes. I don't need a 12-minute squash. And that's what this pretty much felt like. Yeah, it didn't feel like the babyfaces had any chance of winning. There was no, the crowd wasn't into the babyfaces act. It was just a dead match to me.
I mean, it felt like a long match. it was a long one. The, what do you think of Slater, the way they used him in WWF, Pete?
Oh, terrible. Wasted, I mean, right? Yeah. Well, totally wasted. I mean, the guys had legendary feuds with, I mean, coming from, I mean, in Mid-South with Butch Reed and Dick Slater. I mean, he had great stuff in Georgia, in Southwest Championship Wrestling. Where I had great matches with Tully Blanchard and against Gino Hernandez as a babyface, so he can work face. It just did not translate at all for the WWF. I mean, Vince has had a problem always getting Southern heels over or Southern faces over in the territory because it's not his style of wrestling. And you know what? That's fine. It's different, you know, different. That's why it was great for the territories. You know, you cannot get over in one area, but you can get over in pretty much every other area. So, I still think Slater, I honestly, besides Brett, I think Slater by far is the best worker out of the four. Mm-hmm. And I think Slater's comparable to Brett in a lot of ways. But Brett definitely has the pedigree of having a lot of classics that made television and made tape and stuff.
And it's the '80s, man. It was a perfect opportunity to just bring Slater in as a heel from the South with the flag.
Yeah.
I mean, they could have just done it. It's not like they were going to catch any blowback on it.
No, yeah. Not at all.
Yeah. Having him as a face and still cover, you know, carrying out the Confederate flag, and then especially teaming with a guy carrying the, you know, American flag is just an odd decision.
Yeah, just terrible. Yeah. It's just like, man, they could have done so many more interesting stuff. I mean,
Civil War detente.
Right. You know? Yeah. There's so many things that they could have done because, I mean, they could have teamed him with, put him in with, even, I mean, hell, I mean, him and Bob Orton had a history of breaking Flair's neck in 83 with the Bounty. They could have played up their history with putting him in together with, instead of Orton and Morocco, maybe Slater and Orton as a heel tag team. You know, he's had a history, had a really good television match in 84 with Ricky Steamboat, who didn't have a good match with Ricky Steamboat? Mm-hmm. I mean, he could have gotten something there. I mean, it's just one of those great missed opportunities because he really had a canvas full of guys I felt like he could have worked with. I mean, hell, I would have loved to have seen a Hogan-Slater match. I mean, Slater bumping around, he could get real genuine heat on him and be like kind of like the Terry Funk matches with Hogan, which I thought were really good for the most part. So, again, they had – maybe because they had Terry Funk in 86 and Hoss Funk, they already had their cowboy, Southern Cowboys typing away. So maybe it was just bad timing at the time.
All right. So speaking of terrible across the board, let's get to our next match, and that is the Fabulous Moolah defending her title against Leilani Kai. You know they're like a dearth of action when they're dragging out the fucking women for these matches. Moolah has a rare women's title match here this month because we just never see them. I mean, after once like the Richter stuff all ended, like we just never see women's matches. I mean, it's not even to degrade them. It's like we just never see them unless they're at a lack of depth, which they are tonight. Leilani Kai's return to challenge the ever-aging Moolah. Kai's apparently a face here as these former pals collide. Gorilla says Moolah is a personal friend of Bobby, and they actually kiss on the lips as Moolah hits the ring. Bobby says he doesn't want to do business with Moolah, just wants to keep it personal. We get some BS installing to start as Gorilla and Bobby mull over how old Moolah is. Kai attacks at the bell and slugs away, eventually knocking Moolah outside. Kai yanks her back in, slingshots Moolah over the top, but she gets caught with a kick to the chest as she walked over. Moolah goes to work with her nonsense offense as Bobby puts over the prep work she puts in. Moolah batters Kai and knocks her to the floor, and then Kai pulls Moolah out and rams her into the apron. They brawl out there until Moolah spikes her on the table and hammers her with a telephone before slamming her hard on the concrete to cap a nasty sequence. Back inside, we get some hair yanking and tussling with near falls. They lay on the mat. Moolah chokes away. His gorilla says this ref isn't on his top 10 list of referees. Kai fires back away and kicks Moolah down and then drops a leg before going to a head scissors. Moolah breaks free, goes back to her chokes and gouges before pancaking Kai. Kai comes back with a crossbody for two, but Moolah bounces up and chops Kai down and goes to work. Kai turns the tide and hits a soft double axe to the chest for two, but whiffs on a crossbody block. Moolah gathers her, spikes her to the mat. Kai battles back and jaws with the ref until Moolah dropkicks her from behind. She falls into the ref, and Moolah takes advantage and rolls her up for the win. This had like one or two blips of a moment, but was really sloppy and incoherent. The stuff on the floor carried it, but Moolah's offense is a snooze, and the finish was weird. So I give it a half star just because I liked that little sequence on the floor. I thought that was pretty brutal stuff. But otherwise, this was a slog. What'd you think, Pete?
Yeah, I went a quarter of a star. I thought Kai had good fire, and... But yeah, this is just terrible. I mean, the whole, Moolah at times is good as a heel, but then the whole interaction with the ref felt forced and not funny. And if I'm not mistaken, I thought Bobby referred to Leilani Kai as a former women's champion. I didn't know that ever happened.
Yeah, she was at WrestleMania 1. She's the one that lost to Wendy
Richter.
Oh, was
she really? Okay, yeah. There we go. Then I'm wrong. And then you get Gorilla attacking the ref's cred, and that had, I mean, because this match was so boring, it had me start wondering maybe Gorilla did that to build his own credibility as special ref whenever he did that gimmick, because he did it quite often in Philadelphia and in MSG as a special ref for the world title. So maybe he was shitting on all these refs to put the shine on himself as the special ref. I don't know. I thought maybe that might have been a Parv grasping at straws there. But I'm going with it. Yeah, just boring ass match.
Your match time 10:10. It felt like 30:10. I gave it a half star. Did they even acknowledge? Pete mentioned a champion. I'm trying to remember, JR. Did they even acknowledge that they were like mentor and student? Like, did they even talk about that? I don't remember. Did Gorilla or Bobby even mention that they were together at WrestleMania 1?
No, definitely not.
I don't think so. That's fucking stupid. But clearly, here's the problem. I alluded to it earlier. But yeah, there's no doubt. The problem with the show tonight is there's no one around. They've spread the roster all over the world, and there's nobody here. So when you got to drag up, when you need to have a women's title match here, then you know you're pretty thin. I mean, it just wasn't good. Women's division's a disaster right now. There's really no even need for it. Moolah and Kai are just, you know, poking and hair pulling, and although, you know, Moolah's slam on the floor was probably the highlight of the match. That's pretty much it. It was a disaster. The referee really was a mess. The whole thing was a disaster. I almost gave it a dud, but it's kind of hard to give a dud to a 10-minute match. It really has to be bad. And this was close, but not quite. They really don't have a roster of women anymore. We had that quick little, like, you know, the quick little six-day switch in the summertime with Velvet McIntyre, and then that was it. Otherwise, like you said, if you're not putting matches on here, who the hell's going to watch it anywhere else?
Yeah,
and I also I just
why not
I
bring
also,
back
yeah.
fucking Judy Martin? At least she was entertaining.
I know,
when
right?
We saw her beat the shit out of people, and she could go. And, like Leilani is kind of
face. And who was the one she was beating the shit out of? What match was that? The hell was her name? I don't even remember now. But
who?
The one that Judy Martin was beating the shit out of.
It was Velvet, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't Velvet. It was somebody else. It was some other blonde girl.
Oh yeah.
Anyway,
okay. Yeah,
I'll look it up. I'll look it up when you're doing your comment. But. I mean, the roster is so thin, and I don't understand why midget and women's matches have to have all this annoying ref posturing. Yeah. Can they just wrestle? Even if it's bad, can they just wrestle?
No, they see him as comedy entertainment filler. I mean, that's what they
it's
see
so
it
bad.
As. So the ref
it's
has
insulting.
To be part of the show. I mean, that's...
I know. For the midgets, I get, but, I mean, you know, at least let the women...
In Houston, Paul Bosch loved the midgets, where if he brought them in, they would get their singles match, and then they'd also get a mixed tag match with somebody because he loved the midgets. And they didn't always do comedy spots. They actually did some of the best midget work I've ever seen was from Houston.
Not here. I mean,
yeah,
it's all
here.
Just – you're
no.
right. No, you're exactly right, Pete. It's all just posturing and nonsense. And I think that's what takes this match away. I really almost gave it a dud, but I figured, you know, it is Moolah. And, you know, I like the body slam on the floor. That was kind of cool. So I gave her a half star, but this is a shit show. And – 1986 was not a very good year for referees in the World Wrestling Federation in this building. The officiating has been just a fucking – it's been abysmal.
It was Peterson was the chick that got beat up by Martin. No, Lacey was it? Or Desiree? I forget.
No, Lacey Peterson's the one that the husband killed.
Was it Desiree Peterson? Was that her name?
Yeah, it was Desiree Peterson.
Yeah.
Lacey and then her husband killed her because Judy Martin couldn't hear her. No. Yeah, it was Desiree Peterson. Remember, and then they had the match in Boston like 2 days later, and they were even nastier. Gorilla was like chucking them around. Oh, now, that was different. At least that was entertaining. This was just a fucking
Well, that's what I'm saying. Kai is just uninspiring. I mean, the only reason she was even, you know, worth anything at that point back in 85 was because she had the whole, you know, Lauper and Richter stuff tied to her.
Right.
You know, she'll end up being better again, as we'll see coming forward. But at this point, as a singles face challenger, is just, I mean, there's nothing. I mean, it's just a waste of time. We've already spent way more time than we need to on it, I think.
Yeah. No, let's move on.
All right, let's go to our next match, which is not much better, as we have our good old buddy Pedro Morales taking on Dino Bravo, returning to the WWF. Of course, a former tag team champion, Mr. Bravo is, and he pops back in to beef up the roster. He actually began wrestling back in 1970, taking his moniker from Pepe DiPasquale, a wrestler in the early 60s, who had teamed with Dominic DiNucci, held the Jim Crockett promotions and the NWA tag titles, bounced around from there, was a big enough draw in Montreal to get a singles push for a while. Him and Dominic DiNucci captured the WWF tag team titles in 1978, knocking off Professor Tanaka and Mr. Fuji, and then lost to the Yukon Lumberjacks. He and King Tonga formed a team as well for a bit in the early 80s. He was scheduled to headline a card against Hulk Hogan in 86 in Montreal, but was canceled on short notice, and he left the company thereafter. The rumor was that the company didn't want the Montreal crowd to cheer Bravo over Hogan, and Bravo quit as a result. He was not very happy. Then he returned here in late 86 with the new look with the blonde hair. So here we go. Interesting match, as I said. He has a sweet Canada jacket on. Pedro gets a warm reception as usual. Bobby shits on Pedro, saying he cheats and begs for cheers. Pedro grabs a side headlock and plants Bravo with a shoulder block for a one count. Gorilla says Bravo's hired by Johnny V as a manager and then wonders why V wouldn't show up for a match like this. Bravo works the arm a bit, but Pedro shoves him off, and we reset, get more feeling out as we get nonsense rambling about the holidays and travel. Pedro hits an atomic drop and works the arm, but Dino twists the chin lock to take Pedro down. Bobby makes jokes about Pedro's hometown as we grind along. Gorilla says Bravo's born with a silver spoon, and Bobby talks about growing up rich and what that's like. Pedro chops and punches away until Dino bails outside. Gorilla takes more shots at V as Dino comes back in and works Pedro with some power strikes. Dino hits a gut wrench suplex for two and goes to a chin lock as Gorilla says he better hope that the Latin blood doesn't get flowing. Bravo keeps mixing in power offense with pin attempts and rest holds and eventually knocks Pedro to the floor. Bravo pulls him up and throws him shoulder first into the post and then suplexes Pedro in and goes back to the chin lock again. Dino releases and hits a side suplex for a close near fall. Pedro dodges an elbow drop, fires up with left and right hands, and the two end up outside where Pedro batters Bravo and picks up a near fall in the backdrop back inside. Pedro ducks a punch and gets a small package for two. Bravo goes to the eyes, but Pedro ducks a punch and Bravo clocks the ref by accident. Bravo slugs Pedro as well and wakes up the ref, begs for a DQ, but the ref instead gives Pedro the win by DQ to a pop. Bravo cries after the decision. What a fucking waste of time this was. Super boring and meandering. The finish destroyed any goodwill a few of the spots had built up. Why even bother having Pedro win this? You're bringing Bravo back, and basically by doing this, you're saying he's no good. I mean, you're saying he's useless. He can't even beat Pedro at this point. It made no sense. Bravo's anew. At least push him as much as he sucks. I went a dud on this, Scott, and it annoyed the shit out of me. It was such an awful, one of the worst fucking stupidest matches we've seen at this point.
I gave it a half star Bravo's tights, and that's pretty much it. I like the Canadian tights. I did like the jacket. This match fucking sucked, and I think a better ending may have saved it, but what the fuck? I mean, it made no sense at all. Bravo obviously getting booed. I think Pedro almost got booed. It seemed like everything was over-choreographed. Like, at one point, it felt like Bravo bounced off the ropes, then stopped, and after a second, Pedro decided to do something. I mean, it was abysmal. It was atrocious. Just going so slow and the match time. You know how much they gave these two clowns? 14:24. They gave almost 15 minutes of this shit. Unbelievable. I don't know who was booking. Who had the night off? Because whoever was the agent that night should be fucking fired for putting this piece of crap together. I would never have given Bravo and Pedro 14 and a half minutes. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I would have given our next match another 5 minutes. But
it was terrible. This was fucking terrible.
It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. And the ending is dumb. I mean, if you're going to bring Bravo in, why the hell are you having him lose to this, you know, over-the-hill schlub? I used to try, Pete, to talk to Kelly about the love of Pedro that most people in your Titans enclave used to trash. But this is just – it's hard to keep it up. I mean, obviously, 73 Pedro is a lot better than 86 Pedro, but – this is just not good. It is not good at all. Yeah, I'm giving a token half star just because Bravo's Canadian tights were really cool. Otherwise, this match is just so bad.
Yeah, no, the match is the drizzling shits. I gave it a half star also, and I basically because I thought that jacket that Dino wore was fucking tight. This is perfect example of why the Pedro's run here was so freaking bad. It put a stench on the rest of his career, and that's probably why he's not in the Observer Hall of Fame. He's the only world champion, legit world champion, not in the Hall of Fame and from the WWF. And it's because people remember this stinky ass run where he was unmotivated, lazy, sat in holds, would let his opponent get 90% of the offense, and then he'd make his grand comeback at the finish and get the win or whatever. Yeah, this was just bad wrestling. I mean, he just sit and holds. I mean, people, like, a lot of times, a lot of people don't understand the difference between a rest hold and working a hold. What he was doing was pretty much, this is all rest holds, because Pedro was just sitting in the hold. He wasn't trying to work the hold. He wasn't trying to escape. He was more happy to let Bravo put him in whatever hold he wanted. He just sit there. This was brutal wrestling, and gonna be an end of the easy cure for insomnia. I'll tell you that. Terrible,
awful, yeah. Awful. The booking ending just didn't help matters. It really didn't.
No,
help
it
matters.
Was stupid. I mean, at least bail out the match with the finish. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was awful.
Yeah, it's like they had no idea. Like, okay, are we pushing for Pino, or are we still trying to protect this has-been at this point? I mean, it's just, and it's funny. I mean, Bruno comes out of retirement around this time, and give or take a few months, and he looks fantastic, and Pedro looks like dog shit still. I mean, Jesus.
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, it's just, yeah, he's got nothing, and all he's doing is eating guys up. And I mean, I think it's all we talk about is how did Pedro win this, or how did Pedro go to a double countout, or how, you know, it's like no one ever fucking beats him. It's like, and I know the crowd's popping for him, and he's got the legendary name, and they're in New York, and blah, 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 but then stick him with other guys that are going nowhere. You know what I mean? Let him fight fucking Steve Lombardi or these other guys. Like, don't put him in there with guys you're trying to maybe push or that could maybe get over. Like, it's so stupid. It's just dumb the way they're doing it.
Yeah, you think beating Pedro would have been should be big wins for people, you know, and they didn't use him in that way until maybe by 87 when he has nothing in the tank. Yuck.
Yeah, no good. No bueno.
Ooh.
All right.
This coming up is a little better bueno.
Yeah, a little better bueno. It is our WWF title match. Our main event is Hulk Hogan takes on Kamala. Big spot for Kamala, who's been rocketed up the card quickly here. Smart, and they're smart to capitalize on how hot he was. You know, it's like,
yes,
why, you know, why waste time? Like, he's hot. Let's go. Nope. You know, he had the big beatdown of Steel in November. He looks like a monster. He's got an awe about him. Let's just do it now. So he comes out with Wizard and Kimchi. The presence is great. This is wild mania about him. Massive part for Hogan, as always. Gorilla thinks this could be the toughest defense to date for Hogan. Kamala looks great to start, dodging Hogan and leapfrogging him, stunning Hogan, who backed off stunned at what he was witnessing. The crowd fires up here, a Hogan chant, but Hulk tries to slam and fails. Kamala clubs away but misses a diving chop, allowing Hogan to fire up and slug away, mixing in clotheslines and chops. Hulk keeps unloading on Kimchi until Kimchi pops up. Hogan levels him, but that allows Kamala to attack him from behind. Wizard tosses Kamala's horn, and the challenger jabs it to the throat of Hogan. Kamala goes back to work, choking and gnawing away, and then hoisting Hulk up into a big choke before slamming him down. The crowd is really trying to rally the champ here, but Kamala's working him over, eventually dropping a big splash for a close two count. Kamala stays on Hogan, but he eventually starts to Hulk up, bringing a hot flurry of strikes right at the challenger. Hogan kept him running him from corner to corner, and then finally slams the big man. Hulk goes to the leg drop, but Wizard chips him up and then holds him by the legs as Kimchi has the ref tied up. Wizard holds the legs down as Kamala hits a pair of big splashes, but the ref turns around and sees Wizard involved, calls for the DQ. Wizard and Kimchi hold Hogan down and set Kamala up to the top, but he couldn't make it in time. Hogan breaks free and punches him down and then cleans house on the handlers. And the crowd's just bananas here as Hogan wipes everyone out and then poses for the fans. A really fun match for sure. Kamala's been damn impressive so far. Just the presence and feel for the character looks like a spectacle out there. Hogan's really unsure about how to proceed. I thought that was a nice touch early on. The finish is red hot. The Wizard holds Kamala's legs and squashes Hogan twice. That felt like that may be it for the title before you realize the ref is going to see what's going on. The finish is fine too, setting up a rematch down the line. Another good Hogan sprint title match with a random challenger. I went 2.5 on this, Pete.
Yeah, I went 2.5 too, and I think you really make the interesting case about Kamala, about really they hitting the irons when it's hot. And you know, he's, if you really look at it, the Drew money in the 80s, and it was all because he'd come in. And I mean, he wasn't all because of Kamala. He had to have the right opponent, but I mean, he drew well against Hogan here. In World Class, he drew against the Von Erich brothers. In Memphis, he drew against Lawler. In Mid South, he drew against Junkyard Dog and Butch Reed and Hacksaw Duggan. So he's a guy who could come in and he drew good money against Dick Murdoch in Mid-South. He was a guy who could come in and you could get an instant program with him because Kamala was so convincing in playing the gimmick. And people actually, I mean, if you look at it from now, I mean, the gimmick's ridiculous, but because how committed Kamala was to playing it, it got over. It's kind of like Abdullah the Butcher, you know, from the book, or from Mick Foley's book, where you got to live the gimmick, and that's what Kamala did, and it translated to big business. And he's a guy, if you really look at some drawing cards, the dude drew a lot of. He's like an underrated draw where people don't talk about him that much and like the great draws. But man, for like a 3 or 4 year period, the dude was red hot from like 1982 to probably till 86, 87, man, the guy was red hot drawing all over the world, man, in all different types of territories. He'd come in, he'd hit an artery and draw. I mean, he drew against Bruiser Brody. I mean, now he wasn't like, you know, this gigantic draw with Brody where they're drawing like 20,000, but him and Brody drew higher than normal in like Kansas City territory. They drew in world class. I mean, he was a guy who, I mean, I can't put it over enough how well of a draw he was. And then you hit it here because they hit it when it was hot. And here they had a really fun match. Hogan's entrance is always cool to watch. I really love Kamala's heat here, and I like you hit on it about Hogan just doesn't understand what he needs to do, and it was a really fun match. I gave it 2.5 stars. Also,
what do you think, Scott?
I gave it 2 stars. I liked it. A fun little power battle. I mean, I don't think we were going to expect any great shakes because. You know, I mean, Hogan can only do so much with a guy like Kamala, but I thought the leapfrogs and everything, I thought it seemed very special, and it's not often that you get to see Hogan kind of out of his element in a match. It's very unique, kind of fascinating to watch, and I don't think he knew what to do with this guy, which I think also added to a lot of psychology and intrigue. It's funny, Kamala's movements just seem so comedic. Yet the man at the time still taken seriously as a legit threat in the ring, even though he is kind of goofy and waves his arms around and flops around and everything. But it's taken seriously. It's taken to a serious level. It's a good feud. It should keep on going. I don't think it should. I don't think it should stop. I think there's legs for it, even though the Orndorff stuff still going on for Hogan. It's good to have a nice, you know,
it's good to have that alternate one that he can, you know,
right.
When they don't want to run, you can't keep running him and Orndorff into the ground, you know, over and over.
Nope,
so.
Absolutely not.
And that's almost 2 weeks of conclusion anyway. So it's good to mix someone else in. No, I agree with you. This is a good kind of side feud.
And this is what their second feud, right? Orndorff and Hogan. They also had the one in 84, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So they're pretty much, I mean, it's going
to be double dipped into it, you know?
Right. And it's set to end in the very near future. I mean, I think we're just weeks away from it pretty much being done. So,
what's funny, Pete, is they did double dip, but it's funny. It's almost like 84 and 86 were two different audiences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, because the WWF of 84 was still very old and very, you know, by 86, the young kid, the kids were starting to kind of intricate the crowd, the rock and wrestling thing. So it was almost like two different audiences.
Yeah. So
I agree.
Yep.
I agree with you about the double dipping, but at least, you know, I don't remember any of the Kamala stuff in 84. I remember it here.
No, I was talking about. I was referring to Orndorff and Hogan. They double dipped. They did it.
Oh, I thought you meant Orndorff. I thought you meant Hogan and Kamala.
No, Hogan and Orndorff. Yeah.
Yeah, Hogan and Orndorff. Yeah, no, that is true. So it's a perfect alternate feud. It's a big monster. Good, you know, good kind of heel for Hogan to face on the alternate side. And they treated it very local. They did like Hogan did a local drop for MSG Network in the commercial. No, it was very cool. I mean, again, 2 stars. I wouldn't say it's the greatest thing on the planet, but it's better than what we've seen so far. So it deserves a better grade. I would have had Kamala maybe win by DQ.
Just I don't
to
kind of
juice it up a little bit. But otherwise, it was fine. It was what it was.
I just don't think that this isn't one where the record book matters. Like, Kamala didn't need to win by DQ. Like, there's enough setup here for a rematch. Like, he really messed him up bad. And even when, you know, Hogan wasn't exactly, like, ready to win when Kamala got DQ'd, you know, it's not like...
True.
To me, there's levels of DQ, right? So there's one where, like, you know, Orndorff is getting pinned after the leg drop and Bobby Heenan jumps in the ring and hits Hogan and gets the DQ. Do you know what I mean? This saves him from the
right.
pin. That wasn't happening here. Kamala was all fucking over him. You know what I mean? And then we get the DQ. So it, to me, he's better. He's protected okay with this. I thought they did a nice job. And the way he just destroys Hogan after, I thought, set him up well enough, you know, to keep him hot as a challenger. And
yeah,
enough for, like, Hogan to be able to demand... you know, demand a rematch or whatever.
And then we get that hot angle, which we'll be talking about in a little bit. I mean, in our interview segment.
Right, exactly. And we'll get to that after the break. But so Hogan retains his world title by DQ. It was a pretty good match. Kind of woke the crowd up, as the early part of this card was the craps. So let's take a break, because we need to clean the ring up after all of this crap. I mean, let's be honest, JR, this might be the worst half of a house show I think we've ever had. Pretty close anyway.
Yeah, it's not good.
It's pretty awful. Pete?
Which is kind of funny. I think that was the last... You said that same line last time I was on this show.
The curse of Pete.
The curse of, the curse of Kelly's absences.
Exactly. Feeding me garbage.
All right, why don't we take a break? When we return, we've got, what, I think five matches left? Let's see. One, two... four matches left. We'll see if any of them are any good.
No, fine.
And some interviews and such. But first, let us take a breather. And more after this, because... The sun went down, and the night fills the sky. Now I feel like me once again, as the train comes a-rolling in. Promotional consideration paid for by the following... Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com. And we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. all of these shows, plus others available on PlacetoBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacetoBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacetoBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hello, everybody. This is Bruno Lauer. I'm on The Place to Be. You're listening to The Place to Be podcast. You know why? Because it's like Mama says, it be that way sometimes.
All right, Nation, we're back looking at the December 1986 Madison Square Garden house show. It's been a trudge and a slog and just kind of sleepwalking through this thing. You could say we're almost sleepwalking or walking like an Egyptian through this show. It's just trying to get through the end of the year and head into 1987. And speaking of walking and Egyptians, that, of course, is the song playing underneath us tonight. And that welcomes us into our Pop Culture Corner with Scott Criscolo. Scott, what do you got?
Thank you, JR. So as JR tried to allude to, because we all want to see Pete walk like an Egyptian, that is your number one song. As we're actually, it's funny because the day after this, the 27th, was a fresh countdown, but we always do the week before. So this was from December 20th, the Saturday before, as our show this evening's on a Friday. And the number one song was the Bangles, Walk Like an Egyptian, probably their most well-known hit, and from what I've heard, one of their least favorites as a band. Number two used to be number one last week, The Way It Is by Bruce Hornsby and the Range. Number three, a little Wang Chung action. Everybody have fun tonight. At number three, Notorious by Duran Duran. At number four,
Notorious.
Number five, Shake You Down by Gregory Abbott. Now, for those, you're probably thinking, who the fuck is that? But everybody will know that song if you hear it. It's one of those well-known late 80s, you know, R&B ballads. You may not know the title of the song or the artist, but believe me, you know it. Number six, To Be a Lover by Billy Idol. Number seven, Hip to Be Square by Huey Lewis in the News. Number eight, C'est la Vie by Robbie Neville. C'est la Vie. Terrible song. Number nine, Stand By Me by Benny King. And number 10, Next Time I Fall by Peter Cetera and Amy Grant. So there's your Billboard top 10 from the week of December 20th, 1986. The fresh countdown will come out the next day. All right, let's go to the movie theater, and this is a little bit heftier segment than normal because we're combining the previous Friday, the 19th, and Christmas Day, because even back in the late 80s, Christmas Day was a day for big movies. A lot of moviegoers went on Christmas night when the holiday wound down. So, JR, six movies to throw at you, brother.
Oh, boy.
Combined for that came out on that Friday, December 19th, and the day before Christmas Day. Are you ready? We'll begin. I'll mush them all in one group. The first one came out. It made $4,711,220. Looks like it's a sequel, and it's called King Kong Lives. King Kong Bundy lives, Pete. Well, he does, but not in this movie.
King Kong, after being shot down for the World Trade Center, is kept alive in a coma for 10 years at the Atlanta Institute under the care of surgeon Dr. Amy Franklin. In order to save Kong's life, Dr. Franklin must perform a heart transplant and give Kong a computer-monitored artificial heart. He's lost so much blood that a transfusion is needed. To complicate matters, Franklin says there's no species of ape or the animal of blood type to match Kong. Starring Brian Kerwin, Linda Hamilton, Peter Elliott as King Kong, John Ashton, who we got here? Anyone else? Michael Forrest, Leon Rippey, blah, blah, blah. No one else really notable is in this thing.
Okay. All right. The next movie, which made $11,957,943, a comedy, had one of the Weekend at Bernie's guys in it, Brighton Beach Memoirs. I think this is Neil Simon, if I believe,
yep.
If I remember correctly. Yes.
All right. Let's see. Is that Brighton, Massachusetts?
Brighton, Brighton, and no, it is not.
Let's see. Okay, here's the film. Set in Brighton Beach section of Brooklyn, New York in September 1937 in the Great Depression, this coming-of-age comedy features on Eugene Morris Jerome, a Polish-Jewish-American teenager experiencing puberty, sexual awakening, and a search for identity. Jonathan Silverman, Blythe Danner, Bob Dishey, Judith Ivey, and that's about it.
Okay.
Young Johnny Silverman.
Yeah,
there,
Johnny
man.
Silf. Before, right. What was the name? What was that show we did where they were supposed to be, the single guy, was that him? We were supposed to be like, yeah, the new Seinfeld? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that didn't go well.
No. Next movie made $12,303,904. It was an action film. It's actually going to be a pay-per-view in 2 weeks. No Mercy!
Oh, boy. All right.
It's all the pay-per-views mushed into one.
There's a lot here. No Mercy, No Mercy, No Mercy. Film.
A 1986 action film.
Eddie Gillette, a Chicago cop on the vengeance trail, follows partners' killers to New Orleans to settle his own personal score. Richard Gere, Kim Basinger. Anyone else? No one else.
Who cares? It's pretty after that, too. That's all you need. Made $12 million. All right, next. This one made $25,147,055. A thriller suspense film titled The Morning After. No, it's not about nuclear war. At least I hope it's not.
Isn't that the one that's about it? No?
No, that's the day after.
Oh, okay.
I think it's called. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. The Morning After is about the pill.
Yeah, which maybe that's what this is about.
A washed-up alcoholic actress, Alex Steenburgen, Sternburgen, wakes up on Thanksgiving 1986 next to a murdered man, a sleazy photographer. She feels sick and remembers nothing from the night before, calls her friend Jackie to find out what happened, and informs her she went missing out on getting what could have been the best gig of her life while the night before because she was drunk and rude. Starring Jane Fonda, Jeff Bridges, God, no one else. These are all just Kathy Bates is in there, but these are all pretty much just carried by like two people, all these movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you can tell, it is that time of the year where the big stars came out. So, all right. The number two movie of the holiday season made $38,747,385. Very well-known Broadway musical made into a film, Little Shop of Horrors.
All right.
A Rick Moranis action. I'll tip my hand on that.
A three-girl Greek chorus introduce our movie, warning the audience of some horrors coming their way. Seymour Krelborn and his colleague Audrey work at Mushnick's Flower Shop at a rundown, rough neighborhood referred to as Skid Row. In the slums of New York City, they can lament that they cannot escape the neighborhood. Struggling from a lack of customers, Mr. Mushnick decides to close his store. Audrey suggests he may have more success by displaying an unusual plant that Seymour owns. Of course, starring Rick Moranis, Ellen Green, Steve Martin, James Belushi, John Candy, Christopher Guest, Bill Murray, Jim Henson's daughter Heather Henson, cameos one of the patients, Vincent Wong, a bunch of names in there.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the big big Venus flytrap with the gigantic lips.
Mm-hmm.
was the horror. So, and your number one movie of the Christmas season, 1986. It made $137,963,328, made by director Oliver Stone. Pete, any ideas?
Platoon.
You are correct, Platoon.
There you go.
Actually, you know, I think it was actually kind of autobiographical for Oliver Stone here.
Of course, in 1967, U.S. Army volunteer Chris Taylor arrives in Vietnam, is assigned to an infantry platoon, the 25th Infantry Division, near the Cambodian border. Officially led by young and experienced Lieutenant Wolf, but in reality, the soldiers defer to two of his older and more experienced subordinates, the hardened and cynical Staff Sergeant Robert Barnes, and the more idealistic Sergeant Elias. Charlie Sheen, Tom Berenger, Willem Dafoe, John C. McGinley, Kevin Dillon, Mark Moses, Keith David, Forrest Whitaker, Johnny Depp, Corey Glover. So on and on. Big time cast here for Platoon.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's what started Johnny Depp onto 21 Jump Street.
Yeah, within that, I think later that, in 87, because right, isn't that when Fox launched?
Yep.
That's when the Fox Network launched, yeah.
Yeah, this was his big debut, was Depp was on Platoon.
There you go. So, all right.
That it?
So there's your movies for the Christmas season, 1986. Now it is time. Now, Kelly, to Take the field.
Take the field. No music. Let's bust through these since Kelly's not here, and then you can just give his results as we go.
Okay. We begin at Candlestick Park. It's week 16, by the way. This is the final regular season week. The final week of the regular season, 1986, week 16. All right, we'll begin at Candlestick Park in San Francisco, where the 49ers host the Los Angeles Rams, JR.
49ers.
Pete? Any idea?
You can... I'm going to go Niners.
Okay, and Kelly took the Niners as well, and Joe Montana threw for 238 yards. Niners win 24-14. We go to Giants Stadium in the Meadowlands. The Giants host the Green Bay Packers. JR.
I'll take the Giants on that one.
Mm-hmm. Pete?
Yeah, I'm going to go with Joe Morris and the Giants.
Yes, Phil Sims threw for a buck 245, as you just mentioned. Joe Morris rushed for 115 yards. Giants end the regular season 14-2 with a 55-24 thrashing of the Packers. We go to the Kingdom in Seattle, the Seahawks hosting John Elway and the Denver Broncos.
Oof, tough one. I will go with Elway on the road.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll go with Elway on the road also.
All right. Kelly took the Seahawks, and he is correct. Kurt Warner rushed for 192 yards. Seahawks blow the Broncos out 41-16. Oof. Let's go to Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia, where the Eagles host the Washington Redskins, JR.
I will take the Skins on the road.
Okay. Pete?
Yeah, I'll go with Skins on the road also.
Kelly took the Eagles, and the Redskins win 21-14. Oof. Get that one back.
Maintain that.
Let's
lead.
Go to the Astrodome in Houston. The Oilers hosting the Buffalo Bills, JR.
I'll take Warren Moon at home.
Okay, Pete?
I'm going to go with Jim Kelly winning it. Was he even there at that point?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, he was.
Okay. Nope, he was. He was. Kelly took the Oilers. Kelly did rush for a throw for 261 yards, but the Oilers win 16-7. Next, we go to...
Wait, so did Pete take the Oilers? I missed it. And who did Kelly?
Pete took Buffalo.
And how about Kelly?
He took... Kelly took the Oilers.
Okay, so 4-4, and Pete's got 3.
Yep. All right, let's go to the Metrodome in Minneapolis. The Vikings host the New Orleans Saints, JR.
I will take Minnesota.
Okay.
Ditto. Pete? Minnesota.
All right. Wade Wilson. Remember Wade Wilson? Threw for 361 yards. Vikings win 33-17.
Who did Kelly take?
Kelly took the Vikings.
Okay.
All right. Let us go to the Silver Dome in Pontiac, where the Lions host the Atlanta Falcons, JR.
I will take Detroit at home.
Okay. Pete?
I'll go Falcons.
All right. Kelly took the Lions as well. Falcons win 20-6.
All right.
Turk Schonert. Through for 152 yards. That's pretty sad. All right, let's go to Busch Stadium in St. Louis. The Cardinals hosting the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, JR.
I will take those Cardinals.
Okay.
I'm going to go with the Buccaneers.
Oof.
Guy by the name of Steve Young threw for 157 yards for the Bucs, but they lose. Okay, Cardinals win 21-17.
Who did Kelly take?
Kelly took the Cardinals.
Okay. Stop saying it like it and I'm ignoring you. You're not saying it.
What do you have, a fucking complex? I made a mistake. Jesus Christ.
That's like the third straight one. I'm like, what did Kelly say?
Yeah, but you make it like I'm doing it on purpose. God.
I'm not saying you're doing it on purpose, but you're giving me shit back. You're like, Kelly took the Cardinals.
You're asking the question. I'm giving you the answer.
No, you give me a snarky answer.
Who did Kelly take?
Snarky answer.
He took the fucking cards. Christ. I didn't say that.
You may as well be on Scott Keith's blog with the level of snark dripping off of that answer.
Oh, my God. You have such a complex.
All right. Ask me
therapy.
Come on. Enough.
You have therapy.
Enough.
You're Cleveland.
Enough.
Fucking Browns taking on the fucking Chargers. Kelly took Cleveland. I'll say it first then.
Oh, okay. Well, now I know. I'll take the Browns in Cleveland as well. What do you
I'm
going
to go San Diego. I feel Dan Fouts is going to do me right.
Well, he doesn't. Bernie Kosar throws for 258.
You screwed Kelly in that one. I would have taken the Chargers.
Win 47-17. Browns win 47-17. Let's go to Cincinnati where the Bengals host the Jets, 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 Jets.
All right. Well, I never picked the Jets. And I'm usually wrong, but I still like Boomer at home. So I'm going to go with the Bengals.
Okay.
I'm going to go with the Jets with Kenny O'Brien.
All right. Kelly took the Jets as well. Boomer threw for 425.
Attaboy, boom.
Bengals 52, Jets 21.
All right.
The Jets were 10-1 and ended the season on a 5-game losing streak.
Sounds like every other year. Yep.
you wish you were 10-1 in your lifetime at some point.
Yeah, well, the spike year they pretty much were, and the year Favre got hurt, they started off like 8-1 or something.
Yes, let's go to Pittsburgh Steelers hosting the Chiefs. JR.
Oof. Chiefs.
Okay.
Steelers.
All right. Kelly took the Steelers. Mark Malone threw for 351.
Oh wow!
But the Chiefs win 24-19.
Oof. Hot.
Yes. Let's go to Dallas, or maybe not. Cowboys hosting your defending world champion, Chicago Bears, JR.
The Bears.
Okay.
Oh, the Bears.
Going with your boys?
Yeah, heck yeah.
As did Kelly, and the Bears won 24-10. The Cowboys were actually 6-2 when they were tied for first. Then Danny White broke his wrist, thanks to Lawrence Taylor, and the Cowboys lost 7 of their last 8, and this began the slow demise of the greatness that was the Tom Landry era. Let's go out to L.A. to the Coliseum. The Raiders hosting the Indianapolis Colts, JR.
Yeah, I'll take the Raiders at home here.
So did Kelly. Pete?
Yeah, I'm going Raiders at home.
Gary Hogaboom, the ex-Cowboy, throws for 240. Colts win!
What?
30-24. Yes. But right. You don't get hurt because you all picked Oakland or mm-hmm. L.A. And finally, the final game of the regular season from the Orange Bowl in Miami. Dan Marino and the Dolphins host your defending AFC champion, New England Patriots, JR.
I'll take – they're in Miami?
They're in Miami. They're at the Orange Bowl.
I'll take the Dolphins.
Okay. So did Kelly. Pete?
I'll go Patriots.
Dan Marino threw for 266, but the Pats win 34-27. I think they clinched a wild card by winning this game. So what's our tally, JR? How did you and Mr. Nelson do?
You said Kelly took the Pats?
Kelly took the Dolphins.
Okay, so we're good. Pete, and you took who?
I took the Pats.
Okay. All right,
he's
so
the only one that took the Pats.
All right, so Pete, you had 7, finished with 7 for the year. All right, so Kelly for the year. So this week I had 10 and Kelly had 8. For the year, Kelly had 22, 38. He had 44 points for the year, and your boy had 48. So chalk it up for JT for the 1986 NFL Pick'em on the Place to Be podcast.
And there we go. All right. Very good. And, of course, as we get into January, we'll talk about the playoffs, etc. All right. Let's go to the Frozen Pond, see how things were going on in hockey. Pete, if I remember correctly, I believe you're a Blues fan, correct?
Yes.
Yes. They lost 8-6 to the Blackhawks. Kelly's Flames are off. D'Amato's Rangers beat the Devils 7-4.
Yes.
JR, our Bruins were off, but our Whale tied the Canadians 1-1. So a lot of games on that day. Let's go to the National Basketball Association. I think there were a few games on this day, but I believe the Lakers and Celtics both won. Lakers beat the Rockets at home. Celtics won in Phoenix. The high scorer of the day was Alex English in those sweet Nuggets jerseys, right, Pete? Remember those?
Oh, yeah.
Awesome. 36 points, but they lost. Dallas beat the Nuggets 123-121. The standings, Celtics lead the Atlantic at 17-9. Hawks, Dominique and company led the Central at 19-6. Mavericks led the Midwest at 18-9, and the Lakers had the best record in the league at 21-6. And finally, kind of a memorable thing. None of us watched this show, but I thought it was pretty memorable because I guess it was one of the longest non news related episodic television programs ended on this date. Maybe our moms watched the show. But on December 26th, 1986, the final episode of the soap opera Search for Tomorrow ended on this date in 1986. It started back on September 3rd, 1951. So this show was 35 years old and was the longest running non-news related episodic television show to that point. But on this date, December 26th, 1986, the show had its last episode. And there is your final pop culture report for 1986. To back to 33rd Avenue, JR. What do we got?
When we go backstage, Bobby Heenan is supposed to be interviewing Hulk Hogan because he had said he was going to interview the winner of the match. But he changed it and says, fuck it, I'm talking to Kamala, Kimchi, and Wizard instead because they should have won. He should be champion. Wizard agrees. They said Kamala pinned Hogan, but it was injustices that cost him. Bobby plays up that Hogan was afraid, and Wizard piles on as well. They then show a replay of Hogan slamming Kamala. Wizard says he wants a rematch. Hogan comes flying in, and we get a big brawl until they're pulled apart. I thought that was a cool moment. Gorilla then talks to Mr. Fuji about the big tuxedo match tonight. Gorilla puts over his credentials, but says he's a bit off more than he's bit off more than he can chew this time. Fuji says Hillbilly has no ability to think for his own, and a tuxedo match is his type of match. Fuji's not concerned about height and weight, thanks to his hands. Gorilla then talks to Hillbilly about the tuxedo match. Jim has never worn or owned a tuxedo or even a jacket or tie, but thinks it's a nice holiday gift for the fans at MSG. I would disagree. Gorilla tells Jim to keep in mind that Fuji tore up his favorite overalls. Jim said it was the most embarrassed he's ever been, but everything happens for a reason, and now he gets a chance in MSG to give a Christmas present on behalf of all the Hillbillies back home. He says Jim says Fuji's a trickish guy and thinks Fuji may not be wearing drawers as a Japanese custom, but we'll find out tonight. Very trickish. All right, that brings us to our next match, which is kind of trickish as well. And that is Jose Ruiz Rivera taking on Steve Lombardi. And that just gives
Before we get to the match, I just want to comment on one of the promos. I thought the Wizard's promo was incredible here.
He was really pretty good. Yeah,
when he starts talking about Kamala chewing on Hogan's face, I mean, it was just a great line. And they always talk about him being one of the great promo men of all time. And there's just we just don't have a whole lot of footage of him cutting promos. And so it was really cool to see it here. And was like one of the highlights of today's wrestling.
Yeah, and he is the whole package with Wizard and all that with Kamala, I mean, it's such a big part of it, of what made him so great here. Just adds to that imagery and the wild feel. So, I agree, Pete. And Jose Luis Rivera is taking on Steve Lombardi. I'd rather just watch Wizard cut a promo for 40 minutes versus the rest of this card. Gorilla chastises Bobby for interviewing Kamala instead of Hogan, like we promised. This does not look pretty on paper at all. The opposite of a Christmas gift. Gorilla says both men have similar credentials. Bobby says Lombardi's coming along well. Lombardi jumps Rivera at the bell and clubs away before hitting a clothesline and biting Jose. Bobby really puts over Lombardi more as Jose Luis lands a kick to the face and a dropkick before slamming Lombardi down. Bobby keeps calling him Jose Luis. Lombardi blocks a charge, but Louis. Is he saying Louis or Louis? I think he's saying Jose Luis.
Louis. He's saying Louis.
Was it Louis?
He's saying Louis.
Lombardi blocks a charge with a kick and then chucks Jose Luis over the top to the floor. Lombardi follows him out and sends him hard to the post. Rivera comes back in and gets a small package for two, but Lombardi maintains control. Gorilla notes Lombardi's haircut and keeps on Bobby about that interview. Rivera pops up and gets a backslide for the win. Lombardi attacks after the bell, but Rivera fends him off and whips him hard into the post. This existed. Not bad as feared, but kept short, at least, but pretty useless overall. I went a half star, Pete. What did you think of this mess?
I went with a dud, and it felt like this is more of a, okay, guys, get back to your seats. We're just going to throw this in to extend our little intermission here. I thought this match just stunk and was plotting and really had nothing.
Now, see, Pete, you haven't been sitting through weekly Lombardi matches, so this actually was not a bad one for him. So
it felt like it had no purpose. Like it wasn't there to help either guy go up the card. They're both still going to be jobbers at the end of the show. So it was a match with nothing at stake. And so, yeah, I give it a dud.
It was a rare win for Jose Luis, though.
True.
So, if that means anything to anyone.
It helps nothing. I gave this a
job. It helps Kelly. Yeah, I think that's the only person it would help.
Mrs. Boy got the big win.
I gave this a dud. This was fucking terrible. Who thought this was smart to put these two guys together? I mean, seriously. Two of the worst workers in the whole fucking company. You know what I like? I like when Gorilla goes, they have similar credentials. Yeah, none.
Yeah, they both suck. I mean, Jose Luis is only good.
They both suck.
He's only good when he's getting the shit kicked out of him, Rivera, and that doesn't happen here.
Right, exactly. So this is awful. Bobby keeps calling him Lewis, Jose Lewis, like he's a boxer or something.
Yeah, he's whitewashing him.
Yeah, it was awful. And then the roll up at the end, it was all crap. There's nothing more to really say here. That's a 2.5 minute fill of shit. So another dud, first of this entire second half of the show. Rare win for Rivera, but it doesn't help the fact that it's terrible. So,
All right. Let's move on. Up next is that match we did preview last month, and that is Hillbilly Jim battling Mr. Fuji for the big-time tuxedo match. Very random feud. Fine enough, thanks to the build, I guess. Fuji's met with a smattering of boos, but Hillbilly gets a nice ovation, decked out in a pimp white tux. Heenan's all over Jim, cracking joke after joke. Jim stomps on Fuji's hat in his usual stupid hillbilly manner, like he always does. Fuji attacks Jim at the bell, and they tussle until Fuji yanks off a piece of the jacket and tears the shirt. Fuji keeps dodging Jim until Jim traps him and rips the pocket off the jacket. Fuji gets a couple of thrusts, kicks, and eye gouges, and pulls apart more of the jacket before ripping the coat right off. Fuji whips Jim with the jacket, but Jim punches back into it and tears off Fuji's shirt, yanking off his jacket too. Fuji lands a low blow kick and pulls off Jim's shirt and then uses it to choke him. Bobby says this looks like the groom and the best man at a mudlick wedding. Jim mounts a comeback and tears off Fuji's shirt. They circle around a bit until Fuji goes to the eyes, but Jim lands a headbutt and then is able to yank off the pants to the pop and win. Fuji has decorative boxers on and runs away embarrassed. Very messy, but at least quick. The crowd didn't really give a shit until the end. Fine enough. We just don't need to see this again for a long while. I went dud, Pete, and I'm good never seeing this again.
I went a star just because it was a different change of pace type of thing to the rest of the card.
Where, stupid.
Yeah, I mean, it still sucked, don't get me wrong. I was so, at this point, I was so fed up with boring, methodical, lame wrestling. This was just like a change of pace. And was it good? No. But it was different, and it stood out on the card in that way, so that's why I gave it a star, not because of any masterpiece work rate. I mean, no offense, a star isn't good anyway. But, yeah, I mean, if everyone else says it's a dud, I have no problem people viewing it as a dud. But, yeah, it was different. So I at least they tried something, so but it didn't work.
This was garbage. I gave it a dud. I didn't really care. I think this was meant to be like a ha-ha funny thing for the holiday crowd and give Hillbilly something to be happy about. Otherwise, this match was garbage. Back-to-back duds. This is getting dangerously close to maybe the worst show we've ever seen. And we've had some pretty bad MSG house shows, but this may take the cake. Another dud. Another dud. I mean, Hillbilly's over, but I mean, this is just crap. You know, again, meant to just kind of give the fans a little ha-ha moment. And maybe they had a cool giveaway that night or something. I don't know. Or maybe the concessions were on sale.
Would you guys rather have seen these guys work a regular match against each other or the tuxedo?
None.
Match?
Just not at all. Like nothing.
I would think they'd never do anything even have ever.
Okay.
Ever. No, all terrible. Right. Terrible. Another dud. Another dud, JR. Do we have any more coming? We have the dud express line coming here. Does it change?
Maybe. All right. Fink returns and says CV Afi has recovered from earlier and demanded to wrestle Honky Tonk Man right now. Afi and Honky, here we go again, the rematch from earlier. Honky comes dancing out in his jumpsuit for the second time, disrobes and shows off his tights and suspenders combo. Gorilla says he's one of the most hated men in wrestling. Afi comes out jogging, fired up, looking for revenge. Honky tries to attack at the bell, but Afi fights through it and mows through Honky, dancing and keeping on the offensive, but the crowd is just gone. Gorilla and Bobby talk more about the vote of confidence poll as Honky begs off in the corner. Gorilla says Elvis is one of the greatest men of all time. Afi is nonstop in his attack, grabbing a near fall, mauling Honky, pitching him outside. Bobby tells us that Honky calls Jimmy Hart the Colonel now, as we mentioned earlier. Honky turns the tide on the floor, but Afi comes back in, takes over, slamming Honky and trying for a reverse splash off the middle rope, but Honky gets the knees up. Bobby goes hard at the Samoans, saying they're illiterate and can't buy shoes because they don't know their shoe size, and they're all savages that live tree to tree. Just fucking going hard. Says if you combine all Samoan IQs, you may get to 50. I mean, just brutal. Honky gyrates and dances while meandering through some basic offense. Afi eventually gets a sunset flip for two, but Honky pounces up and clubs away for more, pitching Afi outside. Honky punches Afi in the head, and Gorilla says only that would only hurt his hand, of course. His brain says Mother Nature protected the weakest part of the body with the hardest. Afi tries for monkey flip, but Honky blocks it and crashes to the mat. Bobby calls Afi a dummy as Honky hits a shake right on the roll for the win. Honky gloats and gets another one after the bell. A sloppy mess. The crowd didn't give a shit at all. Honky has the character down, but not much heat. A blah repertoire on offense. Afi tried, but didn't have much to work with here at all. And at the end of the day, he's still just CV Afi. Not much here. I went half a star. Talk about the match, Scott. We'll save the post-match for next. But if you want to talk about the match itself.
this is my – I mean, this might be unprecedented for me. I don't know if anybody else in our history since we started this refresh has done this, but I'm giving three duds in a row. This was terrible. The Honky character is fascinating, but it's not helping in-ring because I don't know – you're not sure what he actually wants to do. He's wrestling pretty much like a heel, but he's trying not to because he's trying to stay with this in-between please cheer me kind of thing. And Sibiafi, well, there's really nothing more to say. He's atrocious. So, I mean, the fact that there was nobody in this building on this night because everybody else was either in Pittsburgh or Michigan or, I mean, it's bad. I mean, there is nobody here. I mean, there is minimal, and I mean minimal talent in this building tonight, and it shows. If I had spent, you know, Christmas money for this show, I'd be pretty pissed because this is just not good.
It's trash.
I
mean, you at least get Hogan, which we shouldn't undersell. Like, I mean, Hogan
in 86. No, not at all.
No, I agree with you. It's a shit show, but Hogan in 86 is at least worth probably the admission. You know what I mean?
Probably. Yeah, no, most definitely. Again, Honky's problem is he's in this weird, like, in-between purgatory phase character-wise, Pete, and you're not quite sure what he's supposed to be doing. And as JR said, it's not helping that his offense is fairly basic. Not even Southern, just basic, and it's just not bringing. And when you have a guy like Sibiafi, who really has no fucking clue what he's doing anyway, it just brings nothing to the table. Dud for me, third in a row.
Yeah, I'm going with negative five stars here.
That bad, huh?
Wow. It was like, you know what? We saw these guys earlier today. The once was enough, and now that wasn't good. And so now they gave me, you know, they doubled down on a shit sandwich to me here. And so fuck you. I don't know why we needed to see this again. We saw
they got to fill time, Pete. They got to fill time.
God. Yeah. Pass. Hard sell on this match.
All right. Well, let's get to the highlight of our night. Tito Santana heads to the ring for our next match, but he gets into a shouting match with Honky Tonk Man, who's still dancing around on the floor. Then Honky jumps him and then beats the shit out of him and injures his leg. And I thought that's the best Honky looked. Looked vicious, beating the crap out of Tito on the floor. And that does lead...
Somebody has somebody can sell for him, you know?
Right. Tito's pretty fucking awesome, so it makes sense. And that does set up our next match, which is Tito Santana versus Hercules. Fink starts to introduce Tito, but he's writhing on the floor, which was kind of a douche move. After a break, Tito's still down and getting checked out. Gorilla notes that the repaired knee may be re-injured. Hercules is in the ring, and Bobby hops up to join him and demands a forfeit, tells Tito to get up and fight. Fink officially makes the announcements, and the bell sounds, and Herc jumps outside and pounds on Tito as Gorilla rips Bobby for leaving the booth, which is against his role. Herc shoves Tito inside and works the knee with a focused attack as Bobby takes credit for the look and improvements, and Herc talking about endurance training he does in Colorado. Gorilla asks about the chains he carries, and Bobby says they're a symbol of power and strength. Herc has certainly altered his style a bit of late, too. He's less manic and more measured than he was early on. Gorilla wonders if Tito's knee is torn up again, and Bobby thinks he should quit and just go rehab now. Herc is all over the knee with strikes and submissions, punishing Tito as Gorilla and Bobby keep putting him over. Tito goes to the eyes and breaks a leg lock but can't stand on the knee. Tito kicks Herc away, but Herc comes back with a hard knee to the head. Herc keeps the onslaught on the knee as Gorilla says Herc isn't eating because Bobby's not paying him enough. Even Gorilla thinks Tito may be best to give up and walk away at this point because this could be career-ending. Herc wraps Tito's leg around the post as Gorilla wants to know why nobody from the back is checking in on Tito. Back inside, Herc has the leg scissors on, but Tito slugs free and drops Herc with a forearm to the face. Tito follows with a desperation headbutt to the gut and spikes Herc to the mat. Herc fends off a headlock with a nice shinbreaker, but lays into a lazy cover for two. Herc drops an elbow and heads up top, but eats Tito's knees on a dive. Tito's writhing after that one. He can't take advantage. Tito's able to trip up Herc and rifles away at Herc's knee and starts to torque the leg. Tito gets revenge and wraps Herc's leg around the post, but then punches away at it while hobbling around. Gorilla says that Hernandez, he keeps saying Hernandez, but then plays it off like he's only doing it to tease Bobby. Tito hooks the figure four, and Herc hangs in for a while until Bobby gets up and rings the bell, forcing Tito to break the hold. The referee scolds Bobby as Gorilla dimes him out as to what happened. The referee says the match is not over. There's time left and we'll proceed. Tito clips Herc's knee and pounds away at it with hard forearms, and Bobby is just camped out at ringside now as Tito's pummeling the knee. Herc fights up and tries for a slam, but his knee gives out and collapses. Herc blocks a figure four, and Bobby tangles with Tito in the ropes, allowing Herc to knee him in the back and steal the win. Tito chases Heenan around and then comes in and chases off Herc. I thought it was a really unique and fun match. Tremendous selling by both guys. All of the knee work was great on both ends and never dragged. Bobby was just paying big dividends for Herc, which I think is cool. We see it, saw it with him getting Herc the Saturday's main event match, and then we see it here where he helps him win again. You know, I'm fine with him cheating twice to win. I think it puts over Bobby as a manager. Herc is really impressed. You know, I never thought much of him, and he doesn't anyone that ever hit the radar. But since, like, WrestleMania 2, he's been pretty good on everything we've seen. Not disappointing, really, outside of the big event match with Billy Jack. That was really the worst we saw of him. But since then, he's been pretty enjoyable. Tito's, of course, is great as always. I went 3 stars on this, Pete. What do you have?
I went, if I was judging this on a belt, on a slope average, you'd give 5 stars, but I'm not doing that. I'm going 2.5, and I really liked it. I'm a big mark for the entrance angle, like, you know, all dating back to, like, Sheik and Slaughter. I always liked how somehow the WWF would just start a feud while two guys walking away from the ring to the ring. I've always been a fan of that. I really liked Hercules working over the leg. I enjoyed that. His work wasn't super compelling or anything, but it was basic, you know, stomps, stomps, twisting it, stomps. Nothing, you know, nothing incredible, but good basic storytelling. I liked Tito's comeback. I liked how all his work was, like, full of revenge spots attacking Hercules' leg. But now, if you look at Tito's work, his leg work was so much more compelling than Hercules. I mean, it was a lot more unique, a lot more hurdy looking, a lot more using leverage moves. I especially loved when, like, he was what had him in a, like, a spinning toe hold, and Tito's, like, punching the kneecap. Just, you know, it just had a lot more nastiness to it, while Hercules came across a little bit more pedestrian to me. And, of course, Tito's selling is top-notch. By far, I thought this was the best match on the show when it came to layout and structure and telling a story. And the only thing close was the Hogan-Kamala match. Yeah, this was by far the pinnacle of the show. And, of course, you get with one of the best workers in the company, Tito. And Hercules is a guy who I always thought was a pretty underrated worker who was – when he was motivated, was a game worker, and here we got to see him being a game worker. So good job from both those guys.
What do you think of Herc overall? Like, I know once he kind of, over the next couple of years, he turns face, he slows down a bit, but I thought this first year of him in 86 has actually been pretty good. I mean, he started Rocky, I think it was last December, right, Scott, where he had that awful debut match. But since then, yes. I feel like he's actually been pretty good. I've enjoyed him.
Mm. Your total runtime, longest match of the night, 15:40, and I gave it 3.5. This was, I mean, I could have given it like 11 stars compared to the rest of the crap we've watched, but, I mean, if anybody benefited from the thin roster tonight, it was Herc. Mm. He got a nice spot on the card. He had a lot of chance to shine, got a good opponent, and great psychology, working the knees. And I agree with you, JR, about the pace thing with Herc. He, as a power guy, when you try to be a manic power guy, you look like you're having a seizure. Like, it doesn't work. If you're a power guy and you're working on heavy blows, heavy strikes, you got to take your time. You got to be methodical, particularly in that era. And he's doing that. And that made this match great because he's taking a guy who's very, you know, he's a fast worker, quick strikes, quick maneuvers, and try to grind him down. So it was almost like Tito was working on Herc's knee for the figure four, whereas Herc was working on Tito's to try and slow him down. So it was more defensive than anything else. And I thought that was great psychology. I love Bobby and Gorilla kind of working it over. And to Gorilla's credit, the fact that he's trying not to say Hernandez anymore, but right. Just kind of made up that he was, that he was doing it on purpose when he really wasn't, made it even better. It was just a well-done match on all levels, and again it shines brighter because the rest of the show is what it is. So good for Herc. I was really happy that he got a good platform here to really work a new style of being slower and more
but he's not too slow.
Deliberate.
You know what I mean? Yeah, he's more deliberate. Because
deliberate.
Early Herc was just all over the place. Remember, he was like the wild hair. He was nonstop. But he's right. He found a balance now. He's not slow and sluggish, but he's also not like crazy manic like he was. Pete, what were your just thoughts quick on Herc at this time? Not, forgetting kind of where he heads, but just right now.
Yeah, I do. I enjoy, I've always kind of enjoyed his work. And I think here he's like you guys were saying. I mean, he understands how to work. He's actually an underrated. I think he takes decent bumps for a guy his size. And I thought he showed good psychology. Like, I like this match. I enjoyed his match at WrestleMania 2 with Steamboat. I thought it was a good, solid match. I think when Herc had a good opponent, he could have a good match. He wasn't a guy who was going to carry it. But he was a guy who had, you know, he was having even good matches when he was a stupid invader in WCW. I mean, the guy was a solid worker who kind of gets a bad rap because he had some shitty, you know, some shitty angles with, like, Billy Jack Haynes and then Ted DiBiase buying him as a slave and property thing. But as a worker, I always thought he was a good meat and potatoes worker. And this is a perfect example of when they don't expect him to do too much. And because he's the guy, when you don't have this expectation level of him needing to carry a match, where all he's got to do is play his role, he's really good. And I thought his match here was really good.
Agreed. Any other thoughts on this one, Scott?
Again, yeah. To a comparison about the pacing thing, Herc was almost trying to steal like a poor man's Bruiser Brody in his work in the ring. Bruiser Brody was experienced enough at that time to be able to work manic as a big man, but not Herc. And it's good that he didn't try to keep doing that and dialed it down just enough to where he can tell a good story but not be, you know, plodding and dull. A good move by Bobby and even, you know, just by whoever was helping train him to kind of dial him down and work him in this more deliberate heel style. And the ending was great. I want to mention that. And Tito was Tito. I mean, he's tremendous. Perfect guy to give Herc a good match. I have no problem giving this 3.5 stars. It was fantastic.
All right. So let's head to our final match of the night. You would have thought this would be it, but no. We have the returning, kind of, Blackjack Mulligan taking on Nikolai Volkoff. Mulligan we've actually seen pretty recently as under the hood as the Big Machine, I believe he was. And so we've talked about him then. Disappeared for a month or so after the Machines vanished and now returns as Blackjack Mulligan in his cowboy gear. One more match jammed late in the show. Volkoff and Slick get tepid heat as Nikolai sings and Mulligan interrupts it with his country music entrance. Mulligan's all over Nikolai slugging away with a lot of fire as Gorilla talks about his recent return to action. Mulligan lands a big clothesline and hasn't even taken off his vest or chaps. Mulligan gets a back elbow and grabs a squash win to a pop. Volkoff attacks after the bell, but Mulligan dumps him outside. Nikolai just looks cooked. Mulligan's, you know, looks fine, but it's hard to see him going anywhere at this point, just based on age and everything else going on in the company. Again, this was really just to fill out the final few minutes until curfew. Just, I'm guessing this was a standby match in case Tito Herc, you know, if it went long, they probably just would have bagged it or just fill some time here. Any quick thoughts on this one, Scott?
No, it is our my fifth. Well, I guess I really can't give two duds, but. I guess I did give two duds, but this is yet another dud. But it's kind of I don't say it was not deserving, but it was. It shouldn't even be a match to grade, really. But now, was it before or after this that Fink announced the whole card for January?
It was before this, wasn't it? It was right before this, I think.
He did right before, yeah. So just wanted to make clear that we won't get into what the card is, but Fink, you know, told everyone happy, you know, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year from the World Wrestling Federation. Looking forward to a great year, 1987, and then he announces actually the card for our next foray into the Garden in a few weeks, which will be on January 19th, and he gives the card, which we'll go over that night.
Yeah, I found it weird though, where he announced the card, because like when I used to go to the WWF house shows in the 80s. They would announce, like, the main event or what have you right after intermission, usually after the Kamala-Hogan match, where they'd run the angle, and they'd say, coming back would be the Big Boss Man versus Hulk Hogan in the steel cage. Get your tickets now. And so I found it weird that they announced it near the end of the show.
Right.
And the whole thing, too. Usually they do maybe one or two matches, but...
Yeah.
But yeah, that's it. Nothing to grade here. Blackjack's just there's no reason for him to be there. It's cheap payday. And Nikolai just looks so sad. <Yeah. laughs> It really is. It's amazing how much longer he's in the company at this point. But so that's it. There is your concluding card, and that is it for 1986 at the Garden. Which means, JR, for the final time in 1986,
some awards.
All right, let's do it. So, what do we got? We have our match of the night. I think, for me anyway, it was an easy call, and that was Tito and Hercules. Any dissension here from you guys?
Nope.
No, I'm all good there.
Nope.
Okay. All right, our Cousin Junior Award, which is our worst match of the night. And a lot
Everything
of candidates.
Else.
A lot of candidates here tonight.
The entire rest of the show.
I went with Pedro and Bravo because I thought the match sucked. It was long, and it was so counterproductive to have Bravo, you know, get DQ'd for no reason on a stupid DQ. So to me, that was the worst. You know, I thought that was the worst match of the night. What do you think, Scott?
I want to give it to Fuji and Hillbilly, but that, I think that was meant to suck. So it's hard. I got to be honest. I mean, Afi and Honky was bad. I mean, there's a lot of bad stuff on here, but that was just match bad. I'll go with you on this because everything, even the thinking of the ending and everything else was bad. So yeah, definitely Pedro and Bravo. This should have been better, Pete.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with Jose Luis Rivera and Lombardi. It was just a waste of a match.
All right. Our Hogan Award for our MVP of the night. I went with Hogan. I thought, as always, he was the best. Kamala was a close call, but to me, it was all the whole package with Kamala, which made him great, like Wizard and Kimchi and all that. So I thought Hogan on his own, plus him coming in and attacking Kamala during that interview was really cool. So to me, he was the best. It's hard to go against Hogan. I mean, Tito and Herc were both great as well, but Hulk's Hulk. He gives the presence, the pop, the match, everything about it. What do you have here, Pete?
I went with Tito. I thought he carried Hercules. I don't want to say carried, but I thought he was definitely the glue of that match and then really made it compelling with his selling and then when he made his comeback and stuff. So I'm going with Tito.
What'd you have, Scott?
I got to go with Hogan because without him, this building would have been empty. So
true.
He's the fucking star. He's a world champion.
All right. The worst worker. I thought, again, we have kind of a plethora of choices here. We had Lombardi. You got Rivera. You got, you know, fucking Fuji and Hillbilly. You got Bravo, but I actually went Corporal Kirchner. I thought he was awful tonight. I thought he was actively the worst person in that tag match, completely dragged it down. He was just a step slow on everything, and just I think that's a match that was hurt the most by his involvement. Like, the other guys all kind of sucked, but, like, you know, Bravo didn't really ruin that match. You know, Pedro kind of did, but it was more the booking. To me, Kirchner killed what could have maybe been a good match if someone else was in that slot because the Hearts are good, Slater's good, and Kirchner just really killed the flow of that thing. What do you think, Scott?
He was pretty awful. There's a lot of other awful. C.V. Afi was pretty bad tonight. I mean, there was a lot of candidates, but I'll go with. I mean, you could give it to Pedro because I mean he's just atrocious. Let me think about it. Pete, who do you like?
I'm going with Pedro because I thought he just everything about it. I mean, the booking was bad, but I mean, the work doubled down on the stink factor on that match.
I'm going to go with Pedro. I mean, he should be better. I don't care how old he is. He should be better. And it's opened my eyes going through the new refresh as to how bad he really is. Mm-hmm. For a guy that should be.
So is he off your greatest wrestler, WWF wrestler?
He's definitely dropped about maybe decades of spots, but he might still be on there, but they'll be much more ahead of him. It's unfortunate, too, because he is he was a great world champion, but time has not helped him. So okay. He's got to be on the list tonight.
All right, let's go with the best moment. I went with Kamala's attack of Hogan with the big splash as well. Wizard was holding his legs down. What do you think, Scott?
I think I liked Leilani Kai getting slammed, but no, I'm not. No. I liked that move, too. I liked that part.
My favorite moment was actually the angle, the big pull apart. I liked having Vince out there, having to separate him. Vince usually isn't part of angles at this point in time, you know, so I enjoyed that.
Okay, so the Kamala Hogan brawl.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, the Arcidi Award for the most juiced. I went with Dino Bravo for this one, Pete.
I got to go with Hulk. I mean, Hulk's always juiced the gills in the 80s, so I'm going to go Hulk.
Scott?
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you. I'm going to go with Bravo. He just looks so – I'm used to seeing Hogan at this point like that, so that's fine. But Poffo. Bravo looks so – I mean, Poffo's hair is usually on steroids, but Bravo just looked so puffy. Like, he was, like, Hogan's just juiced. Bravo looked bloated. Like, he looked so puffy. So I'm and kind of misshapen. So I'll go with Bravo.
All right, final grade out of 10. I mean, this is probably one of the worst shows we've seen. Hogan, Kamala, the Wizard promo and the brawl backstage, and then Tito Herc carry it. And Tito Herc, to me, gives a little extra juice because they get a lot of time and told a great story. So I went a tick higher than maybe I should have, but I went 2.5. Sad, but I went 2.5 just on the strength of those three things. And well, I didn't mind the honky, like, attack and stuff, so.
I was expecting you to go higher. I thought 2.5. I was going to give 2.5, but I think I may go lower. I'm going to give it a 2.
Okay.
Tito Herc was really good, and I love seeing Hogan, but there was no excuse for this show to be this bad. There's no excuse. They should not have spread these guys out, you know, Christmas week, fucking all over the goddamn continent. It just made no sense at all. Everybody should have been in this building, and we should have had a hot, crazy end-of-year garden show instead of this pile of garbage for a Christmas show. It's insulting, I'll be honest with you. It's kind of insulting. Yeah, you see Hogan. That's what I think. That's, I think, what upsets me is I feel like the philosophy was, well, we have Hogan. No one's going to care about the rest of it. That's a terrible way to think, you know. And thank God for Tito and Herc. Or this, I might have given this a 1.5 if it was that bad. And it's, again, it all goes to Hogan and Kamala. I give it a 2. This might be one of the worst shows we've ever seen in all of the pay-per-views and everything.
Well, maybe, let's see. What Pete's,
it may not be as bad as like 95 King of the Ring, but it's pretty damn close just in terms of quality.
Well, I mean, it's not meant to be a pay-per-view, but let's see what Pete's grade is, and we'll see if it's the cumulative
aggregate worst
show we've seen.
I gave it a 2 also. I thought it was terrible. And it's sad is there was enough star power on the show where they could have made it compelling. It felt like they should have maybe only ran 3 shows instead of 4, and then they could have flushed out some of the other cards. But yeah, there's enough star power with Hogan and Kamala, the Hart Foundation, Tito Santana, to have enough, to have a decent enough card, but yeah, they didn't work here at all. So I go with the 2.
Yep, so that is the worst overall show, because the June 86, Scott, you gave it a 2, I gave it a 2.5, but Kelly gave it a 3.5. So Pete's 2 makes this the lowest rated show at a 6.5 total score out of 30 for the show. So,
oh, God.
Yeah.
Tough end. Brutal. To 86. So next week we are off, as of now. The plan is for us to be off. We're likely to be back in 2 weeks' time with the January 3rd, 87 Starnings main event, a big one. And Kelly, who doesn't usually join us for those, is going to be on, because we're going to make part of that show a recap of 86. So Stay tuned for that, likely in 2 weeks' time. Anything else you got going on, Scott? Main event or anything coming up?
Well, main event we had last week, great episode. We'll be back. So we're off this week. We'll be back next week, actually, where we will recap No Mercy and look ahead to Nate and I and see who else will be on. Look ahead to Hell in a Cell. Maybe Pete will talk and see if you're around. Maybe something juicy's going on. So that'll be next week. So we're off this week. Enjoy last week's episode we did, and we'll do one next week to recap No Mercy, etc.
All right, Pete, anything going on in your world?
No, I think I plugged it up top about the CWF Fan Fest. So if anyone's out in the Carolinas around that time, come on out. We'll have a lot of fun. I guarantee you we'll be watching some good quality wrestling, and we'll probably have a couple cold beverages while we're at it.
All right. Very good. Very good. There may be a little Jeff loves learns wrestling in your lives by the time you hear this. Who knows with that? You never know. But it's planned and out there somewhere. And, of course, Letters from Center Stage. Be sure you check out episode 20, which dropped a couple weeks ago. The return of Parv. Always exciting, of course. Breaking down our top 10 things. WCW Part 2 to come. So check all that out. PlayStation.com. Social media, Facebook.com/PlaceToBeNation, Twitter, Place2BNation, shop with us, PlayStation.com/Amazon, Tumblr, blah, 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 all that stuff. Be sure to check us out there as well. Mm-hmm. Check out our free Vintage Vault ebooks. Jeff Jarvis assists with those. You can click the right-hand picture on the right-hand side of PlayStation.com. Download those ebooks. They are completely free. So, for Pete, thank you so much, buddy, for joining us. I'm sure we'll have you back soon enough. It's been a blast, as always, even though it was a terrible, terrible show. Appreciate you taking the time and slogging through it for us.
No problem.
Scott? Mm-hmm. Talk to you soon as well. So everyone take care. Likely back in 2 weeks. Talk to you.
The two outsiders, grab your horses and your guns. I said I wish that we could stay here, but I fear our time has come. We can ride out in the darkness, chasing the rising sun. We gotta pack our bags this instant. We're heading southbound to the next town. And if we arrive there so safely, baby, you can lay me down. Lay me down. Lay me down. Lay me down. Well, it's the story of the two. Always on the move, they got nothing left to lose except their guns and their wounds. Now they're crossing border sheriffs, posse on their tail. They'd rather die together than be stuck up in a cell. They drank up all the whiskey and they partied every night, like it could be the last. The bounty said to shoot on sight. So they chased the endless summer, knew it came with the price. They wouldn't stop running till they found a paradise. But the sheriff finally found them with the sight seeing red. So the lovers had to shoot them down and fill them full of lead. They were finally free to find a place to lay their head. And when they finally did, he looked at her and he said, I said I think that we can stay here, cause I feel our time has come. And we can walk down to the ocean and sit with the rising sun. So unpack your bags this instant, no more running from town to town. And now that we've arrived so safely, baby, you can lay me down. Nothing left to do, so wipe the dirt off or take your shirt off. And we should go hit the cantina, we got work off. I said it's hot outside, let me go swimming in your eyes. We've been running for a while, want you late, I'll make you smile. I could never ask for nothing better than this. It's just tequila and the beach, it's fine, salty when we kiss. I said I think that we can stay here, cause I feel our time has come. And we can walk down to the ocean and sit with the rising sun. So unpack your bags this instant. No more running from town to town. And now that we